Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. Ugandans are preparing to vote in presidential and parliamentary elections Thursday after candidates concluded their campaigns Tuesday. Some voters say peace and stability are most important for them, while others want change in a new regime. Lining the streets of Kampala in blue and yellow campaign posters compete for space on billboards, walls, and T-shirts. Blue represents the Forum for Democratic Change Party of main opposition candidate Kizza Besigye, while yellow is synonymous with the National Resistance Movement Party of incumbent Yoweri Museveni. The two men are the top contenders competing for Uganda's presidency. The UN's mission chief in Mali paid tribute Wednesday to seven Ghanaian peacekeepers killed in jihadist attack on their base last week, including the first woman to die as part of their deployment. The assault on the camp belonging to the UN force took place Friday in the northeastern town of Kidal and was claimed by the Malian Islamist group Ansar Dine. Seven bodies draped with the UN flag were displayed during the tribute, awaiting repatriation to Guinea Wednesday. Niger needs millions of doses of meningitis vaccines to ward off a possible epidemic after a spike that has seen dozens of cases reported since January, according to the United Nations Wednesday. The health authorities estimate that they need 3.2 million vaccination doses in a case of meningitis epidemic that came from the local branch of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Adding to existing reserves, the additional doses would allow officials to immunize 2.8 million people. VOA News. Convoys carrying food and medical aid are due to leave Wednesday for besieged areas in Syria, where thousands of people have had their access to supplies cut by both government forces and opposition fighters. The aid deliveries are part of an agreement between Syria and the United Nations. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel says the forces fighting in Syria should agree on a no-fly zone and that the situation in Syria is unacceptable. She made the call in her comments to the German parliament today.
Die jetzige Situation ist also immer noch untragbar.
She says it would be helpful if there was an area in Syria in which none of the warring parties could fly attacks, and if we could manage to reach some sort of an agreement between the anti-Assad coalition and Assad supporters for a no-fly zone as a safety zone for many refugees, then it could save many lives and would help in the political process about the future of Syria. You can read more details on Syria at voanews.com. China has deployed an advanced surface-to-air missile system to one of the disputed islands it has claimed in the South China Sea. It's a move that is likely to increase tensions among China and its neighbors. Images from a civilian satellite company, first revealed by U.S.-based Fox News, shows two batteries of eight surface-to-air missile launchers, as well as a radar system deployed on the beach on Sunday. The United Nations is preparing to ask international donors for $1.8 billion to pay for humanitarian aid to millions of people in Yemen this year. The UN humanitarian chief, Stephen O'Brien, told the Security Council that the appeal will be launched on Thursday. He laid out the effects of the devastation that Yemen has experienced in the past 12 months and said the money would pay for food, water, sanitation, and urgent health care. Japan has launched an A2 rocket carrying a new generation of observation satellite Wednesday. That satellite was launched by the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, and it's equipped with the cutting-edge X-ray microcalorimeter, which observes a wide range of X-rays from space with the world's top-level spectral capability. It was developed with a collaboration between Japan and the U.S. National Aeronautics Space Administration. Pope Francis is his final day to a visit in Mexico, and he's scheduled to hold a large-scale mass celebration to be viewed live by people in Ciudad Juarez and just across the border in El Paso, Texas. The Pope is expected to speak about the plight of migrant workers. More at voanews.com. I'm Francis Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yiswu Hebe, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Ugandans are preparing to vote in presidential and parliamentary elections on Thursday after candidates concluded their campaigns Tuesday. Some voters say peace and stability are most important for them, while others want change and a new regime.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting from Kampala. Details next.
Also in the news, there are reports of another grenade attack in Bujumbura, and the World Health Organization says it needs $56 million for its strategic response to contain the Zika virus.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Kenyan government is planning to build a new prison to confine only terrorist suspects and sympathizers. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi. The facility is intended to deter the spread of terrorist ideology.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta announced plan to build a separate prison for terrorist suspects during a graduation ceremony for more than 2,000 new prison wardens.
We will establish a new prison to hold violent extremist offenders. The truth of the matter is that we cannot allow them to spread their poison to vulnerable Kenyans.
The president did not give details about where and when the prison will be built. Some top security officials have raised concerns about terror suspects spreading their ideology to other prisoners and radicalizing them in jail. During the past 4 years, Kenya has witnessed a series of terror attacks from Somalia-based militant group Al-Shabaab. The group is believed to have sympathizers in Kenya, especially in the Isli district of Nairobi, home to many Somali immigrants. But the notion of a jail just for terrorist suspects is being expected to raise eyebrows in the community of human rights activists. University of Nairobi sociology Professor Octavian Gakuru questions the methods to be used to confine minors and hardcore radicals.
If a 14-year-old was found and even commit crime and mass murder or destruction of life or property, what happens? Those who are Kenyans and also the others who are non-Kenyans are given their due protection and their right to law and justice.
Gakuru says the proposed institution must be a correctional facility where people can reform.
There's this view that human beings are able to also change and reform and improve along the way at one point. So we never quite give up. I think that's also why societies now, some of them have abolished capital punishment.
Analyst Yann St. Pierre, who runs the Berlin-based security firm Mossecon, says Kenya will have to double its efforts to stop the spread of violent extremism and hate messages.
The Kenyan government, like many other governments in Africa and around the world that have to deal with terrorism and radicalization, need to understand that weapons will not only do the trick, they'll have to focus on discrediting the idea as well and making sure that it's no longer as appealing.
Kenya sent troops into Somalia in October 2011 after Al-Shabaab carried out a series of cross-border kidnappings. The group has since killed more than 400 Kenyans. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Ugandans are preparing to vote in presidential and parliamentary elections tomorrow after candidates concluded their campaigns yesterday. Some voters say peace and stability are most important for them, while others want change and a new regime. From Kampala, VOA's Jill Craig finds out what matters most to Ugandans when they go to the polls.
Lining the streets of Kampala, blue and yellow campaign posters compete for space on billboards, walls, and T-shirts. Blue represents the Forum for Democratic Change Party of main opposition candidate Kizza Besigye, while yellow is synonymous with the National Resistance Movement Party of incumbent Yoweri Museveni. The two men are the top contenders competing for Uganda's presidency, along with six other candidates. The candidate considered to be in third place is Amama Mbabazi, a former prime minister to Museveni, who is running as an independent. Joenta Sitenda is a 40-year-old Kampala resident who says she remembers life in the 1980s when the Ugandan Bush War engulfed her country. For her, peace and stability are most important in how she votes.
NRM, I like it. It's my party. It has given us peace. Yeah, we've been able to get skills. It has enlightened us in a lot of things.
Peace is a common refrain cited by those supporting the NRM. Older supporters remember war and do not want a return of conflict, while younger ones, like Isaac Dungu, are influenced by the experiences of their elders.
My father was in prison, of the previous president, Obote. So when Museveni came into power, he released him from prison. So all our family is a supporter of President Museveni.
But other voters, especially younger ones, say they are more concerned with how their country is faring in terms of more current issues, like health care, education, and employment. And Uganda's youth are a difficult to ignore demographic. Out of a population of about 38 million people, 50% of the population is under the age of 16, and another 25% is between the ages of 16 and 30. Lamla Muhindo is a young FDC supporter who is frustrated by what she says are a lack of opportunities in Uganda. She says, "We have a job problem. There are no jobs. I am working at a building, as a painter, as a builder, but I am not destined to work there because I've got some qualifications. I can work somewhere in the office. So maybe when President Besigye comes into power, I can get a chance." FDC supporter Abe Siguja says it is time for 71-year-old Museveni to step down as president after his 30 years in office and enjoy his golden years. He says, "We are ready to take care of President Museveni so he can sit back and relax at his home. We will take the juices, we will take the fruit to his house. Let him rest because he's a grandpa now. He's very old for the nation." On Monday, Besigye was on his way to a rally when police stopped his convoy and detained him, saying he was conducting rallies in the off-limits central business district. Besigye was released that afternoon, but supporters got into altercations with police as they waited near Makerere University for their candidate to continue his campaign. Supporters threw stones and police fired tear gas into the crowd. Both candidates finished their campaigns on Tuesday, as thousands of Ugandans came out to support them at various rallies around Kampala. Besigye has run against Museveni three times before, losing each time amid accusations that the president's supporters rigged the vote and intimidated his opponents. Polls open at 7 a.m. local time on Thursday and close at 4 p.m. Jill Craig, VOA News, Kampala.
There are reports of another grenade attack in Bujumbura. A blast was reported at Gare du Nord bus station today. Security personnel are reported searching apartments in the Ingagera neighborhood. Grenade attacks in the capital center have become commonplace. Motorbikes have been banned from the area because many of the attackers use them to make quick strikes and then escape. Recent grenade attacks killed a child and injured more than 60 people. Violence in Burundi began last April after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. Opponents called it unconstitutional and a violation of the Arusha peace accords. Hundreds of civilians have been killed. The UN Refugee Agency says Burundi refugees continue to flee into neighboring countries. The UNHCR says there are well over 241,000 Burundian refugees in Tanzania, Rwanda, Uganda, DRC, and Zambia. Most of them, about 128,000, are in Tanzania. Rwanda shelters the next highest amount with 72,000.
Greece's defense minister has visited refugee registration centers on some of the Greek islands. He says four of the five so-called hotspots are ready to receive the flow of people coming from Turkey. Greece has been criticized for poorly handling the new arrivals. However, the country has borne the brunt of the migrants and refugees at a time when its economy is suffering. Reuters news agency reports that besides the registration centers on the island, Greece has two relocation camps ready on the mainland. Each has a capacity to shelter 4,000 people. Migrants and refugees are expected to stay at the registration centers for 2 to 3 days before traveling to the mainland camps and then on to other European countries. Meanwhile, a Spanish newspaper website reports some young Moroccans are posing as Syrians to get into Europe. It says when they get to Turkey, they buy a false Syrian identity card for about $66. It then costs up to $3,000 to pay smugglers to transport them across the Aegean Sea to Greece. There are no official figures, but the paper quotes sources as saying 1,000 Moroccans from just one town may have made the journey. Many shared their experiences on social media.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Ugandans are preparing to vote in presidential and parliamentary elections tomorrow. And there are reports of another grenade attack in Bujumbura. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The World Health Organization is scrambling to address the Zika virus that's spreading rapidly through Latin America and the Caribbean. The virus has been linked to birth defects and, in adults, to a type of paralysis. Experts have lots of unanswered questions, as do ordinary citizens, as VOA health reporter Carol Pearson found out.
The most alarming aspect of the Zika virus is a possible link to microcephaly, where babies are born with abnormally small heads and brains. The virus is circulating in Latin America and the Caribbean, but people VOA spoke to in Washington are worried.
I actually just had a baby last June, so I'm very concerned about the mothers.
I have a lot of family members and sisters and cousins that this could potentially negatively affect, so yeah, definitely concerned.
Some doctors say they have found the Zika virus in the brains of babies who died shortly after birth. The World Health Organization says it will take a few weeks more to see if there's a link. The agency also says a test for Zika will be available soon, and the race is on to make a vaccine. People used social media to ask questions on VOA's Straight Talk Africa about the symptoms of the Zika virus. 80% of those who get it don't have any. Josh Michaud of the Kaiser Family Foundation was one of the guests who answered that question.
Among the 20% that do show symptoms, they have those mild symptoms that we've talked about, the rash, the red eyes, and the fever.
Zika originated in Uganda, but did not seem to cause microcephaly there. But should it return to Africa from Brazil, no one knows what the outcome would be. Lisa Ortiz, who spoke to VOA in Washington, had advice as good as any expert could provide, even though she's not one.
We always need to, you know, take precautions just in case. You never know how quickly things can spread.
That's also what the experts say, like Ron Waldman of George Washington University.
I don't like to say this, but I'm afraid it's the truth. We don't have enough information yet to answer many of these very, very good questions that are coming from the viewers and listeners.
You can see segments of Straight Talk Africa on YouTube. At VOA, we will continue to provide information about the Zika virus as scientists continue to unravel its mystery, and as tests, treatments, and vaccines develop. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
The World Health Organization says it needs $56 million for its strategic response to contain the Zika virus. The WHO says its strategy focuses on coordinating partners, experts, and resources to enhance surveillance of the virus and illnesses that could be linked to it. It has tapped an emergency contingency fund to pay for the Zika response until donors respond. Experts from the World Health Organization are going to Brazil, which is the main hotspot of infections. They'll meet with colleagues from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who are already there. The French news agency reports Brazilian authorities have launched a national campaign against the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which carries the virus. Also, military personnel are going door-to-door in Brazil to raise awareness about mosquito breeding sites around homes. In the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration has recommended that blood donations no longer be collected from regions where Zika infections are active. Also, those who may have shown symptoms of Zika infection over the past 4 weeks are discouraged from donating blood, as well as those who may have had sex with a person who recently traveled to Zika-infected countries. In related news, Caribbean countries are concerned the Zika virus could adversely affect tourism this year. The Caribbean had a record tourism arrival and spending figures in 2015. Nearly 30 million people visited the region and spent $30 billion.
The World Bank says the ongoing drought has pushed 50,000 people into poverty in South Africa. Reuters says as a result, the bank has lowered its predicted growth rate from the country from 1.3% to 1.1%. However, the International Monetary Fund says economic growth this year will be even lower, below 1%. 34% of South Africans are reported to be unemployed.
Reuters reports the United Nations is investigating 4 new allegations of peacekeepers sexually abusing children in the Central African Republic. A UN spokesman says the troops allegedly involved were from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The reported victims were internally displaced persons living in the Ingakoba camp in the Uaka Prefecture. The abuse is alleged to have taken place between 2014 and 2015. According to Reuters, the UN says the DRC has 10 days to decide whether to investigate the charges or it will conduct its own inquiry.
As the global price of oil plummets, hijacking of tankers in the Gulf of Guinea has slowed. An armed gang boarded a Greek tanker 3 weeks ago and captured the Russian captain and 4 crew members. The hijackers later abandoned the tanker. Leon Diaz escaped with the crew and demanded a ransom from the ship's owners. Dryad Maritime says the theft of oil in the Gulf has recently declined, but threats to crews have risen. David Arnold talked to Ian Millen of Dryad Maritime in Portsmouth, England, about the trend of criminal behavior in the Gulf.
We did see a reduction in the number of tankers that were hijacked for their cargo of product fuel, so gasoline and the like, when we compare that to 2014. So when we looked at 2015, we just had one tanker that was hijacked, the MT Mariam. If we looked at the year before, in 2014, we had a number of incidents, and many of those were at long range, off Ghana, off Angola even. So we did see that drop off. There are potential reasons for that. Some think it could be because of the change in the oil price, and with that being in a kind of a depressed market, that we've seen a reduction in the oil price, therefore a reduction in the profits available from all oil-related products. And that could be a reason for driving down the advantages to criminal syndicates of doing this kind of work.
Let me ask you then about the regional naval forces, for example, Nigeria. Have they contributed to the drop in oil tanker hijackings?
We've seen more proactive work by the Nigerian Navy, especially off the Niger Delta. Now, this is a kind of a destination area for tanker hijacks for the purposes of product fuel theft. So a more consistent presence in these areas has got to be something that is a deterrent, if you like, for the people that might get involved in this. In 2015, we saw this hiatus of criminal activity off Nigeria between May and October. Now, some people attributed this to President Buhari and the fact that he was new in office. A new broom in control, somebody that voiced the fact that he was going to do something about crime, could have been a factor here. But we think that maybe the hiatus was more due to the proactive nature of the Nigerian Navy in their own territorial waters, using assets that had been ordered and delivered prior to Buhari coming into office. It did, of course, come to an end. And in October and November of last year, we started to see crime picking up in the area again.
A couple of weeks ago, a Greek-owned tanker, the Leon Diaz, was hijacked. They eventually abandoned the vessel, but they took the crew.
In the case of the Leon Diaz and others, in fact, we are probably looking at a motive that is indeed kidnapped for ransom. And in this case, five people were taken off the vessel, taken ashore, held for ransom. It's likely that a ransom was paid recently, and those crew, the hostages, as far as I know, have now been released. Now, this is a different type of crime, and in fact, the most dangerous type of crime we see in the Niger Delta of late, both last year and, of course, this year. People going onto a vessel, taking primarily non-African crew, often Western, but not entirely Western, but certainly non-African crew, taking them ashore, holding them for ransom and waiting for the shipping companies to pay the ransoms before they're released. In 2015, we had 9 incidents of successful kidnaps from vessels off the Niger Delta, and that resulted in hostages of 37 in total. In 2014, it was a similar number, but more incidents. There were 34 hostages taken, and there were 14 separate incidents. And this is, without doubt, the most serious threat.
If piracy continues, whether it's hijacking the vessel and taking the goods or taking the crew for ransom, how profitable is it?
Well, when it comes to criminal profits, you could imagine that if you are taking thousands of tons of gasoline off a product tanker, then you're likely to be making quite reasonable profits. We are talking thousands of tons of gasoline or marine gas oil. You know, it's a lot of money. 14,000 tons of gasoline. That's a lot of money in the hands of some criminals and their network. If you look by contrast at kidnap for ransom, it's still extremely lucrative. The one figure I could probably give you was from last year when one of the kidnaps of the MT Kalamos, we believe that taken from that ship were 2 Greek crew members and 1 Pakistani crew member. And it's rumored that the ransom for that was of the order of about $400,000 to get those crew members back. You can see that that is probably a lower figure compared to plus 10,000 tons worth of gasoline, but equally a lot easier crime to do, which is why we saw so many people kidnapped in 2015.
That was Ian Millen of Dryad Maritime in Portsmouth, England. He talked to David Arnold about the trends in piracy in the Gulf of Guinea.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the Uganda presidential elections with Shaka Sali in Uganda and me, Esther Gidu Yort, as the studio guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Ugandans are preparing to vote in presidential and parliamentary elections tomorrow. There are reports of another grenade attack in Bujumbura. And the World Health Organization says it needs $56 million for its strategic response to contain the Zika virus. Coming up, music from Rwanda. And in our feature segment, a look at Ethiopia's booming leather industry. I'm Yehis Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Sporty greetings, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with a French football coach.
Yehias, a French football coach who guided Zambia to the 2012 Africa Cup of Nations title and Ivory Coast to the same trophy in 2015, is taking charge of Morocco, as we hear now from our African football guru, David Legg.
Yes, Sonny. Herb Renard is off to Morocco. It's a 3-year contract. He'll be in charge of the senior national team. He will also be in charge of the senior home-based national team. That will be the one that will compete in the African Nations Championship, the recent finals, of course, in Rwanda. And he will also oversee the Olympic team. And he's been given, Sonny, quite tough tasks. The Moroccan Football Federation, they want him to reach at least the semi-finals of the 2017 Cup of Nations in Gabon, and that's something Morocco haven't done for some time. And also, he's expected to take Morocco, who are ranked 19 at the moment in Africa, to the World Cup Finals. Now, on June the 24th in Cairo, 20 countries, including Morocco, will go into the pot, and they'll be split into 5 groups of 4, and the 5-group winners will go to Russia. So I would say that's not an impossible task by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a tough one. I mean, if you look at the Cup of Nations group, for example, Morocco will play Cape Verde home and away in March. Now, both sides have already won their first 2 games against Libya and Sao Tome and Principe. Another interesting thing, Sonny, about Herb Renard is he does very well in Africa, but not so well in Europe. He created a sensation in 2012. Zambia went to the Cup of Nations in Gabon as absolute no-hopers. Of the 16 countries, they were probably one of the least fancied. And yet it's history now that they went all the way. They shocked Ghana in the semifinals, survived a missed penalty by Didier Drogba in the final against Ivory Coast before winning that after a shootout. Then Renard went back to France. He took over a League One side called Sochaux, but he couldn't avoid relegation, and he left the club soon afterwards. Then, despite being wooed by Morocco, he decided to go to the Ivory Coast, an Ivory Coast team desperate for success. Their last Cup of Nations title was way back in 1992, and he succeeded again against amazing odds, because in the final against Ghana, they were trailing 2-0 in the penalty shootout, but they clawed their way back. And eventually it was Boubacar Barry, the veteran goalkeeper, who saved the penalty and then went to the penalty spot, took a penalty and scored from it to give Ivory Coast a long-awaited title. Now, Renard decided once again, wanted to go back to France to prove himself there. He took over at Lille. But after 13 matches with Lille, he had only accumulated 13 points. That's 13 out of 39. So in other words, he'd had a 33% success rate. It wasn't good enough for the club officials at Lille, and he was fired. So now, Sonny, a third attempt in Africa with Morocco. Interestingly, Renard is the only coach to win the Cup of Nations with different countries. Hassan Shahata of Egypt, he won the Cup of Nations on 3 successive occasions, 2006, 2008, and 2010, but they were all with his native Egypt. Renard, on the other hand, has won it with Zambia and Ivory Coast, and now will attempt what you could only describe as an amazing treble, trying to win it with Morocco.
In African club football, David, recent action, first leg preliminary round in both the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup tournaments. Let's begin with the Champions League, David, and how about the results?
Right, Sonny, it's Mafunzo of Zanzibar 0, V Club of DR Congo 3, Chicken Inn of Zimbabwe 1, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa 0, Mangosport of Gabon 0, Etoile of Congo 0, Wydad Casablanca of Morocco 2, Douanes of Niger 0, Gomahia of Kenya 1, Knaps of Madagascar 2, St. George of Ethiopia 3, St. Michel United of Seychelles 0, Vipers of Uganda 1, Enyimba of Nigeria 0, Leoli of Lesotho 1, Vitalo of Burundi 2, Olympic Kouribga of Morocco 2, Gamtel of Gambia 1, Stade Malien of Mali 3, Racing Club Bobo of Burkina Faso 1, Zesco United of Zambia 2, Al Ghazala of South Sudan 0, Douanes of Senegal 0, Haroya of Guinea 0, Mbambani Swallows of Swaziland 1, APR of Rwanda 0, Circle Joachim of Mauritius 0, Young Africans of Tanzania 1, Recreativo Libolo of Angola 5, Racing Mekomiseng of Guinea Equatorial 1, Balkan of Comores 0, Kaiser Chiefs of South Africa 4, Cotton Chad of Chad 0, ASIC of Ivory Coast 1, Ons Cretours of Mali 1, Al Ahly Tripoli of Libya 2, Nimba United of Liberia 1, Union Douala of Cameroon 3, Club Africain of Tunisia 2, Kanda of Ivory Coast 0, and finally, Ashanti Gold of Ghana 1, Meloudia Bejaia of Algeria 0.
Thanks for those CAF Champions League results, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. And David will be back later this week with more soccer-licious commentary. Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny.
Andrew, what are the sporty trends on this Wednesday?
Well, one of the biggest trends right now is Manny Pacquiao, of course, the famous Philippine boxer and also member of the House of Representatives in the Philippines. He said in an interview recently that gay people were worse than animals. And so this, of course, set off an uproar on social media. Now, one of the interesting things I found about this was that after this criticism, Pacquiao tried to defend himself, but he took to Instagram to do that.
Okay.
And he cited some Bible verses and things. And then finally, when he realized that there had been so much uproar and these comments were causing harm to his reputation and people were, you know, very upset about these comments, he issued an apology and he went to Facebook to do that. So he wrote out this apology on Facebook. So it's something that really, even though it started with an interview, it's kind of developed and evolved on social media between the commentary that, you know, as people are talking about this, saying that he shouldn't have said that, and then his defending it on social media, and then his apology on social media.
And Pac-Man is pretty active on social media, isn't he?
Very active. And so, actually, it's not very surprising that he took to social media to address this issue, because he does have such a big following, because he is so active there. It's probably the best way for him to get the word out and get to his fans and all of those people that are commenting.
Pacquiao scheduled to fight American Timothy Bradley for a third time on April 9th in Las Vegas. Andrew, can this hurt his reputation, these controversial comments?
It'll be interesting to see. I mean, certainly this apology, I think, will maybe diminish some of the effect that it's had. But I wouldn't be surprised if he lost some fans over this. And come April 9th, it may be a very lopsided fight. But it, you know, remains to be seen. Social media is one of those interesting things where sometimes people apologize and people say, okay, we'll move on. Sometimes people kind of seize on these comments and they become something that really can harm a career and harm someone's reputation. So we'll see as that develops.
Andrew, in terms of social media, I encourage our Voice of America listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. I received a Facebook message from Chuma Birdman Ngona, who writes from Kapiri, Mposhi, Zambia. Chuma says he loves the Sunny Side of Sports, and he urges me to keep up the good work. Thanks for those encouraging words, Chuma. Joshua Gyamfi sent me another Facebook message from Kumasi, Ghana. Joshua is a longtime listener of the Sunny Side of Sports, and he says he hopes I had a happy Valentine's Day. I did, Joshua. In terms of Kumasi, I visited Kumasi in 2001 during my first visit to Ghana. Two quick shout-outs for Kwabena Quicksilver Ofori, who showed me around Ghana on that trip, and another shout-out for the late, great Hot Rod Thomas, who accompanied me on that trip to Kumasi. Rod was one of our veteran Voice of America producers. Thanks for writing, Joshua. Back to Andrew Palcheski. What else is trending out there, Andrew?
This is a very interesting article I saw about the top three social media all-stars in the NBA. Now, we talked last week about the NBA All-Star Game and players actually on the court playing. This is their activity on social media, and far and away the number one is LeBron James.
LeBron, okay. Yes. Now, would have said Kobe.
Well, Kobe's number two in the West. They have it split up into the West and the East. LeBron's number one overall, but also number one in the East, followed by Dwayne Wade and Carmelo Anthony. In the West, it's Steph Curry, who's number one, then Kobe Bryant and Chris Paul. And basically what this is a measure of, it's this company called MVP Index, and what they measure is the social media intelligence. I wasn't quite sure what they meant by that. But basically, it's how much sway these players have in social media, particularly with brands. And they give a very interesting example. They say that Damian Lillard, who is another basketball player,
okay,
he's sponsored by Adidas. He's tweeted in a period of time, say, 80-plus times about his sponsorship with Adidas, his Adidas shoes, those kind of things. In the same period of time, LeBron James has tweeted 6 times about Nike. And, of course, he is sponsored by Nike, has a relationship with them. The 6 tweets that LeBron has sent out in the same period of time where Damian Lillard sent 80 earned more money and more engagement for Nike than 80 tweets, just 6.
So in other words, LeBron is more bang for your buck when it comes to tweets.
Absolutely. And they point out in this article from Forbes that LeBron James is king on Instagram. He's had 340 million plus impressions since this fall. And that equates to, they say, about over $10 million in business. So in addition to social media being something where these players can connect with the fans, where they can show off maybe what they're doing both on and off the court, it's a big moneymaker for a lot of these sponsors.
And Andrew, bringing it back to Manny Pacquiao, perhaps the Pac-Man should follow LeBron in the way he handles social media.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Sonny. I think that in addition to the fans looking at Pacquiao's comments, I think his sponsor is going to be looking at those too. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if that apology was partially because of that. I'm not saying it's not genuine, but there may be other factors at play, like money.
Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Thanks for joining us again, Andrew.
Great to be here. Thank you.
I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to you, Hayes Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny. Thank you, Andrew. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the leather industry booming in Ethiopia. And next, a Zimbabwe professor in South Africa discusses diaspora issues. But for some music, here is Mani Martin from Rwanda with Umumara Rungu. Abandu amagana na Govare bumu mararungu, bumu mararungu, nawe yavuse n'abandi Rwanda's Manny Martin with Amu Mararungu. In Ethiopia, the leather industry is booming as the government offers generous incentives to producers. As Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa, the sector is poised for rapid growth.
Not only does Ethiopia have Africa's largest livestock population, its leather is reputed to be of high quality. There are many incentives for those who wish to see the country become a leather manufacturing hub.
There's still big capacity because there at the moment we are exporting 80-85% of our leather in terms of finished leather, not finished products. So there's a big capacity to increase if we can produce all our material into shoes and into bags and different leather accessories.
Small local factories say they do not worry about foreign companies coming in as most of their market is local.
After 3 or 4 years, we will be like known in the Horn and in Africa, we hope so. Like.
Made in Ethiopia is slowly but surely becoming more recognized around the world. This locally based high-end leather bag company is part of a new generation that is changing Ethiopia's narrative of what can be made in the country.
I think initially it was a foreign concept to kind of produce made in Ethiopia high-end products. And then as far as for my brand, we add a lot of the Ethiopian touch with it. And so that kind of gave us a bit of attention and as well as the quality of the leather. And so the mix of that, it's perceived positively so far.
Although exports increased in past years, the government's goal to reach $500 million in leather exports by 2015 fell short. It now plans to build industrial hubs to further expand the leather sector and the Made in Ethiopia trademark. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Zimbabwean Ricky Mukwanza left his beloved country 9 years ago and is now a lecturer in public management at Swanee University of Technology in Polokwane, South Africa. He now pays school fees for less privileged children in his home area of Moranda Mashun in Chivu. He also buys seeds and fertilizer for other members of the growing diaspora living in South Africa. VOA Zimbabwe service reporter Jonga Kandamira speaks with Mukwanza about diaspora issues.
Back home, I would mention that I assist my relatives and the people who are from the place where I come from, which is Moranda Mashun in Chivu. The assistance that I normally give is in the form of school fees to the less privileged kids in that area. And also, I also give assistance to relatives who do not have, say, money to buy inputs, you know, towards the rain season. You find that you have quite a number of relatives who do not have money to buy inputs. I assist in that manner. Here in South Africa, I assist some Zimbabweans whom I come across from time to time who will be lacking money either for bus fare to proceed to their destinations or where they want to go, and also those who will be saying they do not have money for food. As a person in the academic field, I also assist Zimbabweans who will be looking for opportunities to further their studies. You'll find that some Zimbabweans come here to South Africa, and initially they would want to work, but when they don't find work, they normally want to use the route of going to school and then probably find work later on. So in that case, I give them advice. I also assist some Zimbabweans who will be doing their master's dissertation. Since I'm a supervisor at the master's level, I normally assist Zimbabweans who approach me.
You mentioned that you are sending children to school back home. How many children do you have?
At the moment, I have slightly under 10. The number is slightly under 10 because the resources are limited. But I'm looking at increasing the number to probably 15 to 20 this year. And resources permitting also, I intend to increase the number so that many can benefit from these efforts.
I also understand that you are working with University of Zimbabwe lecturers. May you tell us your relationship here?
Thank you very much. I had actually forgotten to state that I do research collaborations with some lecturers at the University of Zimbabwe. To date, we have worked on a project that looks at public sector budgeting in Zimbabwe. And a book chapter is actually coming out this January. The idea there is to ensure that I'm able to make a contribution in the knowledge sector in Zimbabwe. You would find that the effects of the economic downturn that we have had in Zimbabwe have also affected the knowledge production sector. So my idea is that I must make a contribution in the knowledge production in Zimbabwe.
How do you find time to do all these things outside your work schedule?
Normally, I use that time that I'm supposed to be relaxing with my family. I actually sacrifice. You'll find that in some cases I don't enjoy some of the things that some people at my level are enjoying. I use that time that I'm supposed to be enjoying probably with my family to ensure that I make a contribution to others, particularly those of my home country.
That was Zimbabwean Ricky Mukwanza, a lecturer at Swanee University of Technology in South Africa, speaking with reporter Jonga Kandamiri. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. Eight candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a fifth term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aini, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the Uganda presidential elections with Shaka Sali in Uganda and me, Esther Gidu Yuart, as the studio guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.